your mouth. Well, the title here is actually designed to irritate the English teachers in the audience. If you notice, what rule did you all learn in high school that I have violated in this title? The split infinitive. Now, the nice thing about being a writer is that you get the prerogative to decide when those rules ought to be followed. Because the first thing you have to do as a kid is to learn the grammar rules, but to actually write English that people want to read, you have to learn which ones to violate. Think if you had watched Star Trek, we would never have heard of Star Trek if they had said, to go boldly where no one has gone before, right? To boldly go where no one's gone before. So there's a split infinitive here, not to irritate you if you're an English teacher, but because it just sounds better this way. So how to really alleviate poverty? Why do I say that? That is because what we think of when we think of alleviating poverty is usually not the thing that actually alleviates poverty. That's what's frustrating. I don't know how many of you know the rock singer Bono, who's the lead singer of a rock band called U2. They just released their new album free on iTunes. But Bono is an interesting person because he's been concerned about the poor in the third world for about 30 years. I've been following U2 since I was in high school. And he has actually gone to Africa. He's done things with foreign aid and different kind of things. And he's realized that a bunch of the stuff we think helps people doesn't help people. And in fact, it often ensnares them in the poverty that's causing the problems. And he's now actually very outspoken about the need for trade and enterprise and for creating opportunities for people who are poor to be able to create wealth for themselves. Because that's actually ultimately the only way you alleviate poverty is to create wealth. And so then that leads to a prior question, because there's 7 billion people on the earth, and the brutal reality is that they're not all creating a lot of wealth, right? And in fact, that's the kind of brutal reality, is they all have different interests, we have different talents and different skills, different capacities to anticipate and meet the needs of others, and so our ability to create wealth varies from place to place. So the question is, what are those things that actually allow wealth to be created? Because it seems fairly obvious, it should seem fairly obvious to you, that not every set of conditions is highly conducive to wealth creation. Now, as Christians, I take this to be non-negotiable. I don't think that it's a negotiable question whether we should be concerned about the poor. Now, everybody knows the verse from Thessalonians, you know, if a man does not work, neither shall he eat. Which is true, but it's talking about a specific situation in the church in which Christians were waiting around for the Lord to return rather than working. That's bad eschatology, and the best way to get, you know, taught out of that eschatology is to get hungry. So that was Paul's point there. His point was not that anybody that's poor, well, too bad for them. You know, just starve them out. God and Jesus cared about the poor. They have a heck of a lot to say about it and expect that of us. So the question is, as I sort of implied in the last lecture, if we're actually supposed to be concerned about the poor and our fellow human beings, the poor, the widows, and the orphans, how do you know what to do to help the poor? It's not self-evident. And in fact, if you use your sort of warm feelings in your heart as itself a guide for what to do, it's going to lead you astray, because to actually help people with material poverty is to do something in the economic realm. And the economic realm has rules and principles that you have to understand. And so if you are going to be a Matthew 25 Christian, right, in which we are going to be judged by the way in which we treat what Jesus calls the least of these. Remember, he says that in that parable in Matthew 25. Right? This is one of these verses that Calvinists don't like very much, because it says what? That they're going to be judged by what you have done to the least of these, my brethren, you've done unto me. And the sheep and the goats end up where they are based on what they do. So however you understand faith, it's got to be something that implicates what we do, right? According to Matthew 25, that we're going to be judged that way. So when we see a poor person, we are to see the face of Christ. So we as Christians have the greatest motivation of anyone to be concerned about the poor. But we often don't seem to be especially motivated to think about the foundations of poverty and wealth creation, because we're talking about poverty in this context. I'm not talking about spiritual poverty per se. I'm talking about material poverty. And the only solution to material poverty is wealth creation. right? And so we very often we treat poverty as if it's the thing that's complicated. But as Thomas Sowell, the economist, has often said, the unusual thing is not poverty, it's wealth. Basic subsistence poverty is more or less the state of humanity historically. It's only in certain pockets historically that you get widespread wealth creation. In other words, it doesn't mean everyone is fabulously wealthy, but it does mean that the basic bone-grinding absolute poverty is more or less vanquished. Well, I want to give you an image to think about this. And to do so, I want to tell you a story. It's a picture of a man named Sir Edmund Hillary and a Nepalese Sherpa named Tenzing Norgay. Now, I don't know if you know who these men are. If you're from New Zealand, you would know who these men are because Edmund Hillary is on the money in New Zealand. And the reason is that Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay, on May the 29th of 1953, were the first men to summit Mount Everest. Mount Everest is the highest peak on the planet. It's about over 29,000 feet above sea level at the peak. It's in the Himalayas. The very base of these mountains is higher than most of the mountains that we have in the United States. And so far as we know, no one had ever gotten to the top of these mountains. And in fact, in the previous years, before these two men summited, there had actually been 10 major expeditions, 9 of them British, that had cost millions of dollars and had virtual armies of men working for years to try to get a couple of people to the top of the mountain. And the problem was that nobody had ever done it before. Nobody quite knew how to do it. But what happened is that there were a few technological innovations that changed things. Radios, so that people could communicate across distances to say what was happening with the weather. Oxygen tanks, and just certain kinds of clothing that just allowed people to deal with these conditions. But even then, all these major attempts, and it was not until this day in 1953 when these two men summited Mount Everest. That's the reason we remember them, because they were the first two guys to do it. Now, the Sherpa are people, as you can see, Tenzing Norgay is much smaller than Sir Edmund Hillary, who, by the way, was a very devout Christian, a tall, skinny guy. And Sherpa tend to be slight. They tend to be very dark-skinned. And they live, there are Sherpa villages that are 10, 11, 12,000 feet above sea level. So think about spending your whole life there. And so they're very, very well adapted to get to the top of Mount Everest. Nevertheless, they knew better than to actually try to climb to the top. But of all peoples on the earth, it would be the Sherpas that could do it. And so the British teams always had Sherpa guides that were better adapted. But these teams would get to Mount Everest at the base in about February or March, and they'd set up base camps at 9, 10, 14,000 feet, slowly adapt, and then eventually work their way up to the top. Here's a picture of Mount Everest if you've not seen one. It's a hard picture to get because it's a perfectly clear picture. But you think, well, there's a soft backside somewhere, right? That's the one they use. Now, that's what it looks like right there, right? It's a sort of crazy thing. Now, what's interesting about the route that they took is it was called the Southern Coal Route, because at the time, they could have taken another route along the north called the Northern Coal Route, but it was closed by the People's Republic of China. Remember, this is in 1953. And so they took the route, and so this was a sort of theoretical route once they got to a certain level. People had climbed to certain levels, and then they were just basically on their own to figure out how to get up. Now, in Montana, I'm sure some of you are mountain climbers and maybe rock climbers. You know how this goes. It's a lot easier to do if you know the best way up the mountain. A lot easier to do. Here's a picture of the route that they actually took that was published by the AP and LA Times a few years afterwards. And so it's not really great, but what I want you to see here is here's their base camp down here. And then you see these triangles, right? This is their first camp. But see all these Roman numerals all the way up here? Those are base camps that were not there then. What those are is those are base camps that later expeditions use. So there are tents there. There's sometimes oxygen tanks, basic markers that tell people where to go. They didn't have those. So they didn't have the comfort of previous climbers going before them. They didn't have the comfort of footprints going before them. In fact, they didn't have the comfort of their own footprints going down because it snowed. They were also the only two members of their team. Now, what's funny is you think, well, they got lucky, the weather got good, or something happened. They actually got to a point, it's now called Hillary's Step. What this is, it's a glacier that stops abruptly at a granite face, and there is this crevasse dropping thousands of feet between those two things. This isn't really what you want to see on a mountain climb. And remember, there are no ropes there. And what's funny is Sir Edmund Hillary was very, very a humble person. And so I was able to find a biography where his brother tells the story of this. And all Hillary says is, well, we got to this spot. And I thought, gosh, I don't know that we're going to be able to get up. But I kind of shimmied myself in and worked my way up. Before long, we were up it. You know, that's all he says. So nobody quite knows how it worked, but he got up this thing. All right, my legs get weak just actually looking at the picture, so I'm not going to look back there. Now, why am I telling you this story? It's like, again, with a story that has nothing to do with the subject. Well, I want you to think of these steps, of this climb by Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay, as if it were the steps up the summit of wealth creation and poverty alleviation. They're basic steps. There are known ways up the pathway to the mountain. Prior to 1953, there was not a known pathway to the top of Mount Everest. But now that there is, it's still maddeningly and dangerously difficult, but it's a much easier thing to do, and many thousands of people have done it, and most of them have taken the Southern Coal Route precisely because it's well known. So you can see that's why we celebrate these men, because it was uncharted territory at the time and it was fabulously risky. That's how wealth creation was for most of human history. We didn't actually know at any deep level what the steps were culturally that allow poverty, widespread poverty, to be alleviated and widespread wealth to be created. But if you actually look at the economic literature, if you actually sort of compare the different countries in which lots of wealth is created and compare them with countries in which wealth is not created, you actually can distill the basic ingredients that I think we can think of as the 10 steps to alleviating poverty. And again, this is important because what this means is that we have a different moral and intellectual responsibility than previous generations. Previous generations could be forgiven for having really idiotic ideas about economics because certain things hadn't been tried. But lots of stuff's been tried, and we know a bunch of stuff doesn't work. And we know the stuff that does work, and yet we persist in saying, well, okay, yeah, there is this kind of known pathway, but let's try this here over the edge of the cliff and see what happens. And we like finding cul-de-sacs and cliffs and avalanches and things like that. And a lot of the stuff we do when we try to alleviate poverty actually is off the path. And so my argument would be that what we want to do is say, what's the known path? If we, in fact, let's just say there are 10 steps. A list of 10 is usually easy to remember. What would the top 10 steps be in the alleviation of poverty and the creation of wealth? And these are my top 10. This is my list. I think it's in the conclusion to Money, Greed, and God, but it's a distillation. It's not like I invented these things. This is just an attempt to distill what I think has been discovered in the 20th and early 21st century in economics. The first one's this, the rule of law. And it's tempting, and sometimes the free marketers like me, we get trapped in a kind of rhetoric that implies that the government is bad, period, and it's just evil. And the reason is because we live in an age in which the government has gotten completely out of control and it's metastasized. But it's really important to remember that the function of government, as Paul says in Romans 13, to exercise the sword and to punish the evildoer, to exercise coercively the rule of law is a very, very important thing. And you cannot have the conditions of economic freedom and wealth creation, widespread wealth creation, without the rule of law. Right? The rule of the jungle is that the most powerful and strongest person wins, and they prey on and enslave the weak. That's the law of the jungle. That's not what you need to have. It's not what's going to allow wealth to be created. So the first condition is a rule of law. Now, what is the rule of law? It's really essentially an enforcement of, you know, the several of the Ten Commandments. That people are generally not allowed to kill each other, we're not allowed to steal from each other, we're not allowed to defraud each other and those kind of things. And so you have certain kinds of laws that, and you're punished if you violate them. It's just that simple. I really like this picture. It's now, I realize, very politically incorrect because there's a whole debate about spanking. I frankly think there's a difference between spanking and child abuse, but I can tell you I was spanked as a child. I've never had a bad dream about spankings. I have bad dreams every week about college tests still. Okay, So I grew up when, in fact, I was in a school, a shop class in 7th and 8th grade where we had to make our paddles, which would take about 2 weeks. So that was excruciating, right? It's like, I'm going to have this used on me. So that's the rule of law, all right? So I put that first Because it's tempting often in our rhetoric to say, well, if the government would just get out of the way, the government has a role to play. It has a profound role to play. It doesn't itself create wealth, but it does, if it's doing what it's supposed to do, set up the conditions for wealth creators. Second is limited government. And this is, of course, a kind of, in a sense, a modification of this. The easiest way to put it would be this. We need a government strong enough to enforce the rule of law, which includes, of course, repelling predators and those who would do us harm. So strong enough to enforce the rule of law, but not so strong and powerful that it becomes a violator of the rule of law. Because in the 20th century, it was actually states that were the major violators of the rule of law and that killed more people. It was states rather than individual people. So the government has an important role to play, but it must be limited. And the founders understood this. It's what makes the American experiment so great, is that they knew, okay, we need a government strong enough to do certain things, but we got to set a lot of booby traps so that it cannot sort of absorb power. And so they have the federalist system, the division between the branches, the two different chambers of the House, all meant to sort of set up inefficiencies, essentially, in the government to prevent it from getting too much power. By the way, if you live in Virginia, you can actually get a license plate that has this image on it. And I missed the deadline, unfortunately. So what's the third one? Formal property. I think we had a couple of drinkers come in the back here. So they wouldn't have stayed long. It's like, oh my word, this is boring. So here's number three, formal property. Again, this is an elaboration of what we said before. There's an economist named Hernando de Soto from Peru that wrote a book a few years ago called The Mystery of Capital, that if you're going to read another book other than Money, Greed, and God, this is a very, very good book. And what he did is he's had teams of postdocs, basically, and they went to countries around Central and South America and the Caribbean, and he had them study just some really basic things, like, you know, what does it take to be able to lease property from the government? What does it take to be able to buy a house? What does it take to be able to start a business in these places? And what he discovered is that there were these countries like Haiti, for instance. I know a lot about Haiti. My wife grew up in Haiti. My in-laws were missionaries. Haiti is an utter basket case, and so the government is just barely functional there. And yet it's also an exquisitely complex bureaucracy. And what they discovered is that in Haiti at the time of the study, if you wanted to just lease property from the government, Haiti essentially, the government owns some land, and then about 97% of the population in rural areas lives on land that's not clearly owned by anyone. But if you wanted to lease land from the government, if you were a Haitian, it would take you 19 years and over 100 bureaucratic steps in order to do that. What that meant is that if you're a Haitian, you're not going to rent property from the government, right? And so what he discovered is that there were not all these things that we take for granted in the United States, these formal titling and property processes in which land is not just land. It has a kind of representational existence. So you've got a plot of dirt. What happens that makes it property? The dirt's still the dirt. It's still in the same place. None of the atoms have moved. What's happened is that there's this system, this representational system, in which somebody has a piece of paper that says, I own and have certain rights to this land, and everybody has to abide by it. The government enforces it and has to abide by it. Your neighbors have to abide by it, right? And so it structures how people act. And it has this almost magical ability to allow people to do things. So if you own a piece of property and you've got equity in it, you can use that as collateral on a loan. You can use it to do things you couldn't do otherwise. This is one illustration of how this works. This is one of, you know, picture of, pick any shanty town around any major city in Central or South America. You have like Sao Paulo in Brazil, this beautiful gleaming city. And around the edges of most of these cities, you have these shanty towns that thousands of people live in, and these are essentially what we'd call squatters. They're people that have gotten near the city where the jobs are, but they don't own property. And so what they do is they use corrugated aluminum and steel and stuff like that, and they just build a shanty town and share walls. Very often they won't have basic running water and things like that. So you can see them, and they'll be 300 to 700 square feet of space. Okay, the picture on the right is from Portage Bay. This was 1 mile from my house in Seattle. These are houseboats, same square footage, 300 to 700 feet. And they went for from $7 to $1.2 million. And look at them. They're immaculate. Now, is it because Seattleites are just really, really clean and neat? No, if you've been to Seattle, that's not the explanation. It's because these are owned by people. These are assets. There's a whole system of representation in formal property and titling that exist in Seattle that don't exist here. And so it's not because of some intrinsic virtue of the people. It's because of that system that they exist in that allows them to do it. Now, we inherited this. It developed over a period of several hundred years in Europe through common law in the United States. And so we were bequeathed it. We were born into it. So now the trick is to say, okay, now how do you get property reform and get those kind of institutions built in countries that don't have it? It's a really tough problem. But that's the kind of problem that people that are concerned with third world development should be spending their time on. Because that's going to be one of the keys that's going to unlock the wealth that can be created in those places. Well, number four is economic freedom. And in some ways, economic freedom is the summary of all the conditions that allow for wealth creation. I put it four because sometimes when people hear economic freedom, they think that means everybody getting to do whatever they want to do. That's not economic freedom. Again, that's the Lord of the Flies. It's anarchy with everybody gets to do what they want to do. The rich kids are going to, big kids are going to steal from the weak kids, right? Economic freedom exists when you've got formal property, you've got rule of law, you've got limited government, and then you get the conditions for economic freedom. I'm sure most of you by now have actually seen this image. It gets sent around periodically on the internet. It's a satellite image of the Korean Peninsula. Now, North Korea doesn't actually have that outline around it, but you know, it sort of clarifies where it is. But it is otherwise just a simple satellite image. Look at the difference. South Korea, what we now call South Korea, even at the time of the Korean War, was overwhelmingly poor and rural. It's a poor agrarian country, and now it's a thriving country with a more or less representative democracy and a vibrant economy. And you can see it from space, right? Look at North Korea. Okay, so this is, what I like this is it's a perfect experiment if you think, well, maybe certain ethnic groups are more suited to this, or maybe certain climates are more suited to this, or different places that have natural resources. The Korean Peninsula is virtually ethnically homogenous. It's one of the most ethnically homogenous places on the planet. The climate's more or less the same. The history is more or less the same. The cultural institutions that preceded the present are more or less the same. There's one difference. There are the political and legal institutions that exist north and south of that line. And you can see the difference from space. Now, if you're an astronomer, my friend Guillermo Gonzalez looks at this and goes, wow, look at all that darkness in North Korea. You know, but that's a kind of quirky way of looking at this. We know that the light is a sign of prosperity, right? That's the result of economic freedom. And the Heritage Foundation for many years has been doing a study, a complicated assessment of this called the Index of Economic Freedom. And there's a very tight correlation between economic freedom and prosperity. And every year, you get Hong Kong at the top, it still treated its own country, and you get usually North Korea at the very, very bottom. In some ways, that tells you what you need to know right there, those two data points. Right, as I mentioned in the previous lecture, this is why economic freedom is the golden mean between extremes. You need a government, you need the rule of law, but it has to be limited, and then it sets up this realm for free and voluntary exchange when you get those details right. I'm not going to tell you that story, but I'm going to remind you of it. Because remember, the trading game, that exists, right? That only works when there's rule of law. That's something that it's easy to forget that in the story, that there's an implicit rule of law. There's the rule of law in kids' hearts. Hopefully, they kind of more or less know they're not supposed to threaten other kids for their toys. There's the teacher there just in case. There's the principal and there's the parents that will be told what the child did. That rule of law is in the background, and so it constrains what they do, and it sets up those conditions. Number five, strong mediating institutions. This is something that was mostly ignored by economists until the last few decades. Economists tended to treat, you essentially had institutions, banks, governments, markets, and then just these isolated individuals running around, just these little utility maximizers, as economists said, running around calculating their self-interest and things like that, forgetting that there are all sorts of institutions, parts of our social reality of society that aren't the state and that aren't the individual. They mediate between individuals and the state. So they're called mediating institutions. They're between those two things. This is the socialist and progressivist temptation, is to treat everything that's public and social as if it's the jurisdiction of the government. Remember, our dear president a couple of years ago said, the government is the only thing that we all do together. That is a perfect distillation, a doctrinal statement of progressivism. It's crazy. What? The state has existed for, you know, a couple hundred years. There was a heck of a lot of stuff happening before that that people were doing together. And so one of our jobs is to reinvigorate and emphasize the absolute necessity of these mediating institutions. Now, what are they? Well, most important, of course, is the family. When we know this, you can sort of figure it out rationally, that the family, a man and a woman together, it takes exactly two to mate. That's why the logic of monogamy requires a male and a female, right? It takes a male and a female in a complementary relation to mate, right? To be able to produce another of its kind. Now, so the logic, incidentally, of the two breaks down if you've got two men or two women. There's no rational basis for it. So that's the primary relation, because only a man and a woman together that can create other people, right? So that's what makes it fundamental. It's bounded in our nature and our biology, and then the children and the family around that. Of course, the story in the first chapters of Genesis makes that point, right? It's man and a woman and his children and her children that exist first prior to the state. So they are pre-political realities, as philosophers would put it. They exist before that. There are others, right? There's the church, right? These exist, certainly the Christian church has existed for 2,000 years. There's a Protestant church, there's an Orthodox church, and there's a Catholic church, right? But the Christian church, Christianity, have pre-existed the state and will likely, though we don't like to think about it, probably post-exist the state that we're used to. They exist outside the state. That's important. So it's not like the government defines what the individual is. The government doesn't define what marriage and the family are. The government doesn't get to define what a religion is. What a just and limited government does is it recognizes those things outside its jurisdiction in its laws. It's a crucial distinction. It doesn't define them, it recognizes them. That's what the Constitution and the Bill of Rights do. They don't define philosophically what the human is or the individual. They say there are individuals and they have certain inalienable rights. But there's a bunch of others that we forget, right? They're educational institutions, none of which were actually initially a part of the state. There are groups like the Boy Scouts, martial arts. Anybody that's taken martial arts, it's amazing the things that can instill in you. Things like the Rotary Club, charitable organizations, symphonies. That's Benaroya Hall in Seattle. Those are the mediating institutions, and it's easy to forget about those things, but there are groups of economists now that actually study the economic consequences of these things and the economic consequences of not having these things. And so I talked to some of my libertarian friends that call themselves libertarians in Washington, D.C., and unlike in places like Montana and Texas, people that call themselves libertarian in Washington, D.C. and New York are mostly atheists. And so what they're interested in is not just limited government and free trade and things like that. They're interested in just kind of, it's like the pelvic issues, to put it in a coded way, since their kids are here. And so they think that it's actually, freedom is sort of expanding when you get sort of new sexual options and new lifestyle options. They don't actually understand that when you destroy the family, you destroy the fundamental mediating institution between the individual and the state. And so it's not complicated to understand that if the family is utterly destroyed, there's still kids running around. Somebody's going to take care of. I mean, what happens is that the state ends up in your business on everything. And so if you think that the destruction of the family is an expansion of freedom, you're not thinking clearly through the consequences of this thing. So this is why if you believe in limited government and free markets, you need to believe in strong families and mediating institutions. Well, six would be something, and this is a little bit more abstract, but it's a purpose-driven universe. There's a wonderful book by a guy named Rodney Stark called The Victory of Reason. And Stark talks about and summarizes the work of a bunch of other scholars. It points out the way in which the Judeo-Christian sort of intellectual inheritance gave rise to the institutions of economic freedom in the West. And he points out the ways in which, for instance, if you believe in a rational and orderly universe, right, you're going to act differently, you're going to prepare. You know, if you think the universe is created by a rational mind and a rational and benevolent being, as the early founders of modern science did, you actually might try to spend some time trying to work out the logic and the rules of those things. If you think nature is an illusion or is just a sort of, you know, interplay of a bunch of capricious gods that are fighting with each other, you're not going to expect any kind of rationality, and so you're going to be unlikely to engage in the kinds of scientific and technological enterprises that would give rise to wealth creation. So he argues, I think quite persuasively, that belief in a purposeful universe actually has profound economic implications. That's not so simple that a culture is Christian is going to be prosperous, and if you're not Christian, it won't be. It's more complicated than that. But there, think of it as a sort of tendency. And so there actually is a connection between the general theological beliefs of a culture and its economic institutions. And I do think there's a case to be made that the emergence of Christianity in South Korea, coincident with economic freedom, is actually not so much of a coincidence. Seven's the right cultural mores. Now, this is a really difficult thing, and the claim's not that everybody has to be righteous. If everybody had to be entirely sanctified for there to be institutions of wealth creation, there would be no institutions of wealth creation, right? Because we're all sinners. But you might think of it this way, is to really have institutions of wealth creation, society needs to be at least minimally virtuous. And so what that means is that people generally have to respect the property of others. They generally respect the work of others. They generally respect the rights of others. So people don't just, as a matter of course, steal from each other and defraud each other and murder people if they can get away with it. You know, this makes perfect sense. I know a missionary who told a story, and I won't name the country, but it's a very poor developing country, and the inland part of this island country, people are, you know, if you're out on the sort of edge of the country near the ocean, people could fish, and so they tended at least to have access to fish. But in the inland part of the country, people were actually quite poor. And this missionary realized that, you know, there are actually lots of little creeks and streams just sort of sputtering off in the area. And there was a low-lying area that was owned by one man. And he said, you know, if we rerouted all these things, we could actually create an artificial lake and we could stock it with fish. And so he got everybody to agree to this. You can imagine how hard this would be. A lot of subsistence farmers, but they actually did this, created this artificial lake, stocked it with fish, which was itself a difficult task. People started eating better. They had jobs. Most of the people in the area ended up working, either caring for the fish or the hatchlings or taking the fish to market. Everybody ended up better off than they had been beforehand. But what happened is that the guy that owned the lake started getting better off than everybody else, and he pulled away. Right? He was richer than the rest of them. And the second that started happening, the other villagers started jumping over the fence at night and stealing fish out of the lake, and the whole operation fell apart. Okay, now, what's going on there? Well, one thing that's going on is a lack of respect for the property of others, but also a failure to understand what's going on economically. Right? They weren't noticing that they were better off. They were noticing that that guy was better off than them. Right? And so there you've got cultural mores that have to do both with just basic morality, right? Don't steal, but also with a basic understanding of economics. And this is where I actually spend most of my time. And that's number eight, is understanding the nature of wealth and poverty. If you don't know that a free exchange is a win-win game, if you don't know that wealth can be created rather than transferred, right? If you don't know that it's possible to set up a system where people can pursue their legitimate self-interest and serve the interests of others, you end up thinking really stupid things about the economy. So you think, if that guy's getting richer than me, he must be getting richer than me because I'm getting poorer, right? Or at the cost of me. And so that means it's really important when you're assessing the morality of what's going on to understand what's going on economically. And so there's both a moral and an intellectual component. The good news is that understanding wealth and poverty doesn't require higher math or calculus or anything. It just requires the kind of stuff we're talking about tonight. Now notice up to now, I've not really even talked about anything you would learn in an economics course. I don't think, even used a technical economics term. I'll do that one time here. Once you get those things in place, now it kind of gets down to the individual level. It's very important to realize that what individuals do in certain societies matters. And so the same person, say Steve Jobs, if he had been born and lived his life in Haiti, the same person, same genetic endowment, would not have created anything like the wealth he did create because he was born and lived in the United States of America, right? And so the same guy, based upon his particular location, does something entirely different. But then you do get down to sort of your individual level. And at that point, we still have decisions to make. So remember the puppetry guy I joked about in the previous talk. When you are focusing on your comparative advantage, what that means is that you need to focus on the things that you can do well or that you can do better than a lot of other people and that would meet the needs of others. So when you're making sort of economic decisions, you can't just think about what you like to do and what you want to do, but what needs to be done for other people. So it's always naturally kind of other-directed. But comparative advantage is actually this kind of technical idea that's really strange when you first hear it. And so here's what comparative advantage says. Imagine you've got four countries, okay, and three countries are poor and backward and everyone's uneducated and has no skills. And then one country, everybody is strong and smart and upright and has all the skills. And everything that could possibly be done can be done better in country A than in the other three countries. Nevertheless, the people in country A can only do so many things. They can't do everything. And so what comparative advantage says is that everybody still ends up better off if people still do the thing that they can do the best, even if there's somebody out there that can actually do every single thing better than they can. Now, that's the one weird thing you got to learn in economics. Because that country A can't do everything, it's still better that they pick the thing they can do the best, and then those other countries do some of the other things that they can do less well, but still do, and then trade with each other for everything. They all end up better off. That's what comparative advantage says. And so here's the example. Imagine you've got a dad and a son here, and look at this picture, right? They're doing yard work. Now, you know there's something wrong with the picture. Right, okay, so the little skinny kid, right, he's pushing the lawnmower, it's as tall as he is, and the dad's doing the raking. Now, it's likely the dad could do every task of the yard work better than his son. But the dad is still better off if his son has a little skill, but the dad ought to be doing the mowing and the son ought to be doing the raking. That's comparative advantage. Now, we're assuming the kid can at least rake and won't, you know, end up under the mower or something like that, right? So that's the scenario. That's comparative advantage. And so what that means is that individuals and towns and regions and even entire countries are better off if they focus on their comparative advantage. It makes sense that the Danes and the Norwegians do not grow bananas, right? They could. They could build greenhouses and grow their bananas, but it is much, 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 much cheaper that they buy their bananas from places like Nicaragua. Now, that sounds strange to people. Gosh, it has to be transported. But if you think that's a waste of energy, let me sort of disabuse you of that. I've got a book coming out next month, and I talk about this. So I called the Maersk Corporation. Y'all know what Maersk is. It's the shipping freight company, a Danish shipping freight company. And I talked to a bunch of guys. Finally, I got to an Indian guy named Vikram. And they sent me to him, and I said, okay, here's what I'm trying to figure out, is how many bananas Maersk ships can transport. And he said, want to know what? We've got the exact data, and we've got it on bananas, and we've got a new ship. And there's a new Maersk ship that can put 11,000 shipping containers on one ship and can transport enough bananas for every American and every person in Western Europe to have a banana for breakfast. All right. So what that means is the transport cost of individual bananas is essentially zero. Essentially zero. That's comparative advantage, big time. Right, and so it makes sense that for some things, local produce is great, you know, but local produce when you live in Duluth and Fargo in the middle of the winter is not that great of an idea. It's not your comparative advantage because it's frozen, right? And so that's the idea, and that's a basic economic insight, and it's a little bit complicated, so I left it for the last. And also comparative advantage can just have to do with basic location, natural resources, things like that, right? That's the one complicated one. And then 10 is work hard. Right? It still actually does matter that you work hard. But again, why did I say 10? Why didn't I put that at the beginning? Because it's not true that just working hard by itself can lead to wealth creation. If you're in a bad situation, you can work your fingers to the bone. You can work yourself to death and not even create enough wealth for yourself, let alone for others. Look at this poor fellow. Those are water bottles. Okay? He's pulling those things with a bicycle, a three-wheeled bicycle. That is hard work. You know, but I suspect he's not especially wealthy. Right? He's not getting in his Lamborghini at the end of the day. Those would be on the back of the Lamborghini if you had one, obviously. So that's why it's important when you think about hard work to realize that work and toil, the exact same labor, right? Like digging a hole, right? If you're digging a hole out in the desert, you might be working really hard, but nobody needs the hole. The exact same activity someplace else in Hollywood where you're digging a spot where a pool is going to go, right? That's wealth creating because of the setting. That's a really important thing to remember. These social settings have almost everything to do with wealth creation. And then finally, the lesson that you heard already in the previous lecture is this amazing insight that human beings are themselves wealth creators. Because what I want you to now notice about those 10 steps is to talk about steps, you think of those as physical entities. Now go back through my list and ask yourself, how many of those things are physical entities? Rule of law, private property, limited government, economic freedom, cultural mores, understanding wealth and poverty, belief in a purposeful universe. Those aren't material things. The only one that's even partially material would be that comparative advantage, something like natural resources. What that means is that all the preconditions for wealth creation, for material wealth, are actually immaterial realities. And that's precisely the kind of thing that you could believe to be true if you think an immaterial God is the fundamental reality, but that you would not expect if you thought matter is all there is. And I will leave it there. Thank you very much.